This is a HeadGum Original.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Have I told you this story before?
Dude, you have built your life around this. This is one of the five things about you. I've known you. How long have I known you?
A decade almost.
I've known you close to a decade. And what I love about you and your approach to comedy is the way that you find, like, literally just 4 or 5 facts about yourself, and then your comedic approach is to continually chew them up, regurgitate them, and then swallow them back again and do it over and over again. I hope that didn't come off like an insult.
Not at all.
It's a compliment.
Okay. Not at all. There was a period in the middle of what you were saying that for a second I thought this could be an insult when you said that I take 4 things and repeatedly regurgitate them.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. I was told that the reason...
I've heard you say, Tom Hanks told me I have dead eyes, countless times on countless stages. This is your voice. This is what you do. So I am thrilled to be here talking to you about your dead eyes today.
I'm talking to my friend Adam Conover. I met Adam about a decade ago. At the time, he was a sketch teacher at UCB, but he was also taking improv classes. And he and I ended up being on an indie improv team together for a few years. Adam then moved out to Hollywood, where he immediately got his own TV show, and now he never stops making new TV shows. He's a very nice guy, which is why we're friends. He's also talented and smart and funny, but the reason I wanted to have him on this podcast was because I knew he wouldn't hold back in telling me his candid opinion
at that point,
about
yeah.
any of this. Two things that I was thinking about. One was, I know specifically there's an episode of your show that's about memory.
Mm-hmm.
Your show, Adam Ruins Everything.
Yes, people can watch this episode on Netflix. You're talking about Adam Ruins Forensic Science.
But that episode really had me thinking about my relationship to this story, because you were talking to memory experts about how, like, people will tell the same story once a year and it'll change. I must be doing it with this story.
Oh, you certainly are. There's no question that you are. I'm not a memory scientist, but we interviewed the memory scientist Elizabeth Loftus on the show, who's brilliant and eminent in this field. And the way she describes it is our sort of folk understanding of memory, the way we talk about memory with each other, is that it's a recording device, that things happen to us and we record them and then we can go back and play the tape back. But even when you look at your own experience of having a memory, that's not what it's like. You know, you're not playing it back directly from some spool of tape. You're imagining it based on a story that you've told yourself. The way she describes it is it's not a tape. It's a Wikipedia page. And you can go in and edit it. But also other people can edit it too by talking to you or asking you leading questions about it. So that's where it comes in terms of witness tampering, for instance, that the police, through asking certain questions in certain ways, are actually able to change witnesses' memories, sometimes without either of them realizing it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
My own sort of feeling about it is that when you think back about your memories, like, what do they all have in common? What they have in common is, for the most part, it's that you remember them often. Right? Sometimes it's something that was really remarkable that happened to you or very meaningful to you. But often it'll just be this little trivial memory that you just, for whatever reason, you think about it at least once a year. It comes back to your mind. And so what are you really doing then? Every time you play that memory back in your head, you're repeating it to yourself. You're telling yourself the story again. And of course, you're making little changes to it as you do that.
Yeah, because you're redrawing it in some ways. You're tracing over it.
That's a good way to put it. You're tracing over it, or you're copying the sketch over and over again. And so, of course, you're making little adjustments.
Yeah.
Because what you're actually remembering is the previous time you remembered it. You're telling yourself the story over and over again. You've shaped the memory into this particular replicable shape. And so that is the thing in your head, not the original event anymore.
I'm shocked sometimes by things that I think I remember, and then I'll find like concrete proof that I'm remembering it wrong.
You know, I was talking to my girlfriend the other day, and I said, hey, remember that funny story that your friend told us about her life? And she said, no, that didn't happen to my friend. That was in Ali Wong's comedy special.
Wow.
You transplanted a story from Ali Wong's very funny comedy special, Baby Cobra, and you misremembered that my friend told you that story. I was like, that's baffling, because I remember where we were. We were on a trip, and we were having dinner, and she told me that story at this particular dinner. Nope, it was from Ali Wong's comedy special.
How can we know anything when our brains are that tricky?
Well, we just need to know that our minds are fallible.
Our minds are fallible, which is one reason why I kind of wish I had kept some kind of a journal over the years. My dad is always telling me that I should keep a diary, keeping track of all the various people I come into contact with in show business, just so I can retell the stories years later. It's amazing how much I forget. And it's not something I've ever done, journaling, except in the case of the day I was fired by Tom Hanks, which I preserved in a 4-page comic that I wrote and drew not long after it happened, when the details of it were still fresh in my mind, before I had retold this story too many times. I wanted to analyze this with someone who knew what they were talking about, so I met up with my friend, the award-winning illustrator and cartoonist Mael Dalivaux. If you are unfamiliar with Mael's work, this is something you should remedy as soon as possible.
I keep explaining this podcast to other people, and I was like, oh, it's like Serial, but about something really insignificant.
That is the pitch for it.
Yeah.
Is what if there was a mystery that didn't matter?
Yeah.
This is because, you know, no one really got hurt in this. Anyway, Mael and I are going to talk about this 4-page comic that I wrote and drew, which I realize is a weird and potentially off-putting thing to do in an audio format where you can't see the thing we're talking about. So I'm putting all 4 pages of the comic online where you can go look at it if you want to. If you look on Twitter, I hashtagged it with the hashtag DeadEyesConnorComic. It feels like no one else is going to use that, right?
So this was your first ever comic made as an adult?
I think maybe, yeah, because I didn't do a lot of this. I didn't try doing this very much, because what I found very quickly was that it was a lot of work and it wasn't as satisfying to do for the amount of time that it took. You're so helpless when you're an actor, because if no one wants to hire you, it's, you know, how do you generate your own work? And the thing that appealed to me about comics was the idea that, like, well, all I need is like a bunch of paper and a pen and some ideas. Like, there's nothing stopping me from making a comic book or a comic strip. I can just make it.
Yeah.
I drew myself for some reason as completely bald. Like Charlie Brown. I think I had read that Scott McCloud book, Understanding Comics,
yeah,
that said, like, well, there's a reason that we identify with characters that are
right,
just simple and iconic. The reason we look at a smiley face and think that's a face, whereas if you draw like a specific face with a weird beard and you don't look like that, you don't...
Well, fewer people can relate to it as opposed to a more stylized kind of drawing.
I think for this, I was deliberately trying to make this relatable.
Hmm. Right. It's a very universal story, one where Tom Hanks fires you at an audition. All right, so panel one has the title that says My Day with Tom Hanks, asterisk, 2-time Academy Award winner. And then Connor, presumably, saying, what a nice guy.
Yeah, and that to me, that feels like it's me being super sarcastic, because I'm like, he won 2 Oscars, and I'm being like, what a nice guy. And he was nice to me. But at the time, I was like, I felt very burned.
It's coming across a little bit. I'd say the snarkiness kind of levels up as you go
Yeah.
throughout this comic. Panel two caption at the top reads, "You see, I was a young actor struggling to find work." Connor sitting in what I first thought was some kind of airplane seat.
Yeah, it's just a chair.
Okay.
Just in a waiting room, yeah.
They asked me to come to Hatfield Studios for a costume fitting. Then again, Connor in what could be a plane, but is most likely a car, mm-hmm. having a funny line to the driver in front of him saying, "To Hatfield, Bernie," to which the just the back of the head of the driver is shown saying, "Yes, sir."
Now, the best thing about this comic strip, I think, is that it preserved a lot of details that I otherwise might have forgotten.
Mm.
I know that the driver's name was Bernie.
That's true.
It was very hard to draw the inside of a car.
It seems like you're trying to avoid drawing a lot of things in this comic. Is that fair to say?
That is a great observation. I loved drawing what I loved drawing, and I didn't like drawing anything I didn't want to draw, and that was a problem.
Mm. So my favorite panel, I think, in this whole strip is this last panel on the first page.
Mm-hmm.
Because the caption reads, "They cut my hair. Best haircut I've ever had. Took over an hour." And then there's a picture of, again, bald you.
Mm-hmm.
With a pair of scissors hovering above your head, saying, "Nice work." And I don't, this is where it gets confusing, because if you wanted to include the haircut, why did you still draw yourself bald?
Well, you know, Charlie Brown isn't bald.
Uh-huh. But I feel like it's still indicated in the way that Charlie mm-hmm. Brown is drawn, with having just, like, all you need is the three lines
right.
or whatever that make up
just
his
like
hair.
One curly line yeah. on his forehead.
Yeah.
But I think I was picturing that there was hair and you're just not seeing it the same way. I think that was my joke
invisible
about...
invisible hair.
You're right. It doesn't... It's confusing. I also think... You say that's your favorite panel. I think that's a terrible panel.
Well, I think it's my favorite because it's...
Because it's so bad? It's like bad folk art.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm being excessively harsh, but I feel like that...
No, I think it's fair.
It's fair. Okay. Page two. So the first panel says, "Then, the day before my filming, I get a phone call from my agent. Should I do it in British accent?
Sure.
Tom Hanks wants to meet you. He's having second thoughts."
Now, here's what's interesting. In this whole comic, there's all this detail from the story. And I don't know why, but for some reason... I don't include the thing about me having dead eyes in the comic.
Hmm.
And I had forgotten that there's no mention of it in the comic. I say he's having second thoughts. And for some reason, I chose not to include the part where he says he thinks you have dead eyes.
Do you think it was too painful?
I don't know. Part of me is honestly a little bit worried because of the nature of memory and the way that we change stories. There's a part of me that worries that I invented it. I don't think that's true. But the fact that it's not in the comic, it just makes me question my memory of it. But the only thing I can think is that maybe I was embarrassed about it when I drew the comic, and that even though I was trying to be warts and all, maybe I thought that made me look like it was my fault. And I very much was trying to play the victim in this comic.
"Oh no, Tom Hanks, asterisk, doesn't like my audition tape. He doesn't like me, asterisk goes to 2-time Academy Award winner."
I think I thought that was a funny burn because it's not.
You like know what I mean? The 2-time Academy Award winner was the burn?
Yeah, I think I thought if I kept mentioning that every time that it felt like a burn while actually being an impressive thing.
I read it more like, oh, if a 2-time Academy Award winner doesn't like my audition tape.
Yeah, there's that too.
What am I doing?
Yeah.
Page three.
It's a long panel.
Yeah. Most of it is empty space, so to speak. And on the right side, on what is very distinctly a couch, is sitting Tom Hanks. I think what's interesting, though, is you've clearly drawn him with dead eyes.
Yeah.
Was that done purposely?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Because you've drawn them similarly to how you drew yourself, but the eyes are much larger, so it makes the emptiness in the middle of the circle mm-hmm. seem more vacant?
My guess is no. I think I was just trying to draw Tom Hanks as best I could.
Did it feel, do you remember if it felt therapeutic making it?
It did, actually. It did feel like, well, I've got it down on paper. It did feel like I had exercised something of the experience.
I think that that's a big reason why I think people who make comics and like making comics mm-hmm. do it. I think there's something that we get out of putting all our thoughts on the page like that. And then it's kind of like you don't have to think about them again sometimes.
Yeah, it did. It did feel like when I finished doing this, I thought about it less afterwards. Mm. So the next panel is Tom Hanks in more detail.
The caption reads, "He shakes my hand." And then Tom says, "Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for coming in." And then the second caption says, "He doesn't like me." Caption, "I read my four lines of dialogue with some guy named Gary." And here again, there's a terrifying looking drawing of Gary and Tom Hanks, just with nothing in their eyes, just looking at the viewer. Mm-hmm. It almost could be in some kind of horror movie, horror comic.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You think that's scary?
Yeah, I think that's scary. You don't think that's scary?
Yeah.
Last page, first panel, caption. "Bernie drove me back to the train station." Image of, it's almost identical to the first picture of you in the car, except this time you are sweating / crying. I think
it's all supposed to be tears.
Okay.
But yeah. It looks like sweat and tears.
Yeah, I think because it's
They're flying from everywhere.
Top of your head. Then the second to last panel, a caption saying, "Saving Private Ryan is on cable. Tom Hanks just got shot." And then you snuggled up in a blanket on a couch or a chair.
Yeah.
Looking at a television. The television says, "Earn this." And you going, "Oh, shut up." And then, whoa, this is pretty harsh. This caption reads, "I'd like to give him a smack."
Yeah. It's just me being angry. Like, yeah. It's just me trying to talk tough the way that I was seeing a lot of, like, bitter alt comics people.
That was the flavor. I will say, this like isn't just kind of, you. That was the flavor of the time.
Yeah, to me it was like I was reading stuff like Ghost World, and it was me like trying to be snarky like Enid in Ghost World, you know, where it's like, fuck this, you know?
It does read differently when it's
a
20-year-old white guy versus a young teen girl. Yeah,
25.
How old were you, 25?
24. I was 25 by the time I drew that, yeah.
Okay.
And then it's the last panel now?
Last panel. So this is projecting us far into the future, into the year 2025. And the caption reads, "Tom Hanks wins his 10th Oscar. He mentions me in his speech." Old Tom Hanks crying says, "Boo-hoo-hoo, sorry, Connor. Wah." And then you don't look like you've aged other than your beard is extremely long now.
And it's gray, like. It's very salt and peppery, I think.
And Era's pointing to you saying, "Me, an old drunk." And you saying, "He remembered. What a nice guy." And the final caption, "All is forgiven, Tom."
Yeah. Well, I don't drink. And we're 6 years out from that. And there's no way for him to win that many Oscars by then. So I got that wrong. All is forgiven.
Wouldn't it be great, though, if because of this podcast, you actually did meet him and he read this? And
I would hate for him to read that, honestly.
But then he wins an Oscar and he, like, does this really weird thing that nobody but podcast listeners understand.
If he said, "Boo-hoo-hoo, sorry, Connor," for his speech, yeah, I think that'd be really something. I don't see it happening, no matter how well this podcast does.
I don't know.
Well, thank you for analyzing that. Do you have any final thoughts about that?
I think it's better than you think it is.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm just embarrassed about some of those jokes near the end where it gets really bitter.
Yeah, it definitely takes a turn at the end, and I don't know whether you were just like, "I don't want to draw anymore, and I have to get the last chunk of these feelings out."
Yeah.
And it's all going to happen on this last page.
Yeah, I think I was like burning down the comic as I drew it.
But sometimes I think you have to put all that emotion into your art so that you don't have to feel it afterwards.
Well, I think I know how to control it a little bit more now. Mm. I think this podcast will be a little bit more considered than that comic, which is kind of a rough draft of at least part of it.
You don't seem as bitter.
I don't feel bitter.
Good.
I mean, I understand what show business is more now than I did back then, good and bad parts.
And I think, like we were saying earlier, like, you don't care as... I mean, you care.
I think what you were about to say is true, that I don't care as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a weird thing to be like, it's good that you don't care as much, but...
It is a good thing.
I think so.
It's very true. I there are times when I couldn't care less.
Dead Eyes will be right back in a moment.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
When I decided that I was going to go back and explore my Band of Brothers experience for this podcast, there was a short list of people that I knew I absolutely wanted to talk to. And near the very top of that list, the actor who played the role I had originally been cast in, that of Private Zelinsky. His name is Adam Sims, and I don't remember how I first learned that that was the name of the actor who got the role after me. But I know there was a time when I would visit his IMDb page every now and then to see what he was up to, as if that would provide me with a glimpse of what alternate career I might have had. This year, I tracked down Adam Sims on Twitter. I saw that he is now a highly acclaimed voice actor, winning Audible's Audiobook Narrator of the Year in 2017, narrating books by Murakami, Patricia Highsmith, James Patterson, all kinds of heavy hitters. One of the producers of this podcast, Harry Nelson, was looking over a few of his more recent IMDb credits for voice work on a few video games, and he said, "I've played those games. I've probably heard his voice before." As it turns out, Adam was completely unaware of our connection and had no idea who I was or what had happened to me. He listened to the first episode of this podcast, and I was a little worried that he wouldn't want to talk to me. But he turned out to be a really nice guy. We talked for about 2 hours over Skype, and I finally got to hear his side of the story, how he got the part that I had booked and then lost. But during the course of our conversation, we also realized that our stories were much more intertwined than either of us could have known at the time.
I was very nervous about reaching out to you.
Because you?
I did... there are versions of this podcast that could be very like a crazed, bitter old actor, you know?
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. It's funny, isn't it? Talking about our failures and our successes, they have a weird place in our personal histories, don't they?
They do. And that's part of why I wanted to do this in the first place was I have no idea what your experience, this is what I'm fascinated by, because I have no idea. I know you've heard my version of what happened to me. And then obviously I knew that there would be a point where I'd be watching an episode and the character that I was supposed to play, I was going to see like someone else was going to do this. It was a very strange feeling. Did you audition during the same period that I would have been auditioning for it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was the kind of thing that we all knew. Every man and his dog, as the British like to say, was going in for those auditions, right? I mean, everybody was going in. They had so many speaking parts, even the small, like small ones, medium-sized ones, whatever. Yeah. Plus they had a ton of extras. I remember doing an audition in some hotel across from Green Park, and it's always on the sides was they said, you're in a trench and you've been injured badly and you want to get out. And I remember on the script, the only line was, one word, which was A-A-A-R-R-R-G-G-G-G-H-H-H. Right?
So you, every actor's favorite line to deliver.
Right? So you have to go in there. And I remember sitting in this room in this quite grand hotel, hearing, you know, being in a room of other guys, we're all kind of an age, you and I are probably a similar age, and young soldiers in the trenches, and you'd hear a guy go, "Rawr!" And then he'd come out, and then they'd say, "Billy," and Billy would go in and, "Rawr!" And then he would come out. And I remember thinking, what am I doing here? I just thought this is a very strange audition to be in. But I did two or three auditions for different parts. And I hadn't done a huge amount of on-camera auditions at that point. Ended up, I didn't land any of those auditions. I just kept on going in and doing little bits and pieces. And I think, oh, what would a Band of Brothers want today? And then 3 weeks later, they'd say, "Oh, we need a guy who's dying in a field, not a trench." And I'd go back and do the field death or whatever it was. The other auditions that I did would have been for other parts, but I imagine once they saw your dead eyes, they must have thought, "Let's look elsewhere." And I bet you that's when I was considered for it. That's what I'm thinking. I bet you that must have been, unless one of the ones, because I was only seen, here's my timeline. This is the important part, is that I met Gary Davey. This is 2 days after getting the sides. Got to his office in the afternoon, and there were two other actors there. And three of us got into a minivan with Gary Davey. And we drove through rush hour, through Regent Street and up through North London. And then finally, you know, the fields start to appear. And then you reach Hatfield. And that has to be one of the most bizarre pre-audition experiences I've ever had. This was weird because there's two other actors in this vehicle.
And you all know.
We all know that we're going for the same part. And Gary Davey there is there as well. I remember one of the actors wanted to tell jokes, and he was nervous, and he was just telling jokes and gags and personal stories. And then the other guy wanted to chat with Gary and be friends with Gary. And I thought, I don't know, these guys, I bet you they're good, and I can't compete with this energy that's in this vehicle.
Oh, it's so horrible. That's so horrible.
But at that point, I have no idea whether or not we were told that we would meet Tom Hanks for the audition. And it was late afternoon by this point. And we were shown into a room, and the three of us just waited to be called. One odd thing that happened to me is that I asked if I could use the bathroom. So I went in, and I was standing there at the urinal, and no joke, I was standing there and the door opened. And then someone came up next to me, and there was Tom Hanks. And I thought, there's Tom Hanks. And I looked back forward at the brown gray wall in front of me. And I think I said, "Hey, how are you? Yeah. How are you? Good. Yeah." And then I thought, just don't say anything. I thought, be normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I washed my hands. I went back and we waited.
That was the audition.
And that was the audition. And I was the last one to go in. So the other two guys were called in first. And then I went in and he said, "Hey, I saw you earlier." And I did the read. There wasn't much to say, as you remember.
Yeah.
And then I was taken back to the room. And then we waited 20 minutes. We just sat in there. But we were all, like, the adrenaline just crashes.
Yeah.
You know, it's just gone. And we were just relieved to have somehow survived. We thought, we're alive. We're here.
The two other actors in that same circumstance, like the guy who was making jokes or the person who was sort of wanting to talk up the casting director, it's not hard to imagine those guys flunking the urinal test in the sense of, like, if you have a great line and you come out with it in the right moment, it's wonderful. But on those instances where you don't have it, even a little, you don't fully have it, it's almost there and you go ahead and say it. Those are the stuff of nightmares.
True. In the moment, you realize this didn't work. This did not work.
Here's what I wonder about the timeline. I was in a car with Suzanne Smith, one casting director. Meanwhile, you were in a car with, who was your casting director? Gary
Davey.
Gary Davey. Why did that name feel significant? And that's when it hit me. The 4-page comic that I drew at the time. Page 3, panel 3.
I read my 4 lines of dialogue with some guy named Gary.
I didn't just pick that name at random. I had read my re-audition scene opposite some guy named Gary, casting director Gary Davey, the man in the other car from London to Hatfield with the 3 potential actors who were coming to replace me.
Well, here's another thing, and this makes me feel good about my memory. So I did a 4-page comic that was called My Day with Tom Hanks.
No way.
And what I just realized is when I drew the audition, I say, I read my 4 lines of dialogue with some guy named Gary.
Come on.
Yeah. So I was reading with the other casting director. So he was there that day. And I'm wondering whether this wasn't like, we got one car that has the 3 potentials. We have another car with a dead man walking.
I think they were already filming episode 5.
They definitely were.
Absolutely.
I waited in the office for a long time. Let me see if the comic says how long I waited. It says, I have to meet Tom Hanks at 4 o'clock. And then it says, 5:11, Mr. Hanks will see you now.
You wrote all of that down all those years ago.
So I waited for 1 hour and 11 minutes, and I'm confident that time is accurate. So I think I was definitely fired by 5:20.
I remember after having the costume fitting and getting in another car and being taken back to South London, I remember that England was playing a European Championship group game that night. And I remember going into the house and there were other friends there and we all sat down and watched an England game. So if we went back onto the UEFA website and looked at England group games, which would all be documented.
Right.
Are you looking?
I mean, I'm not sure exactly what I'm looking for.
No. So how would I do this? Let me bring this up. If I say...
At this point, Adam and I started frantically searching to see if we could verify the specific date of this football match that happened on the day he was hired. And if it was a Monday, that meant in all likelihood it was the same day that I was fired. Now, if this were a true crime podcast, this would be the equivalent of a repressed memory of, you know, the murder weapon or the location of a second body. But, you know, this isn't a true crime podcast. It's just this.
It was a Monday. June 12 is a Monday. This confirms what moments ago was just dramatic speculation that it all happened on the same day.
At the same time, like a coordinated military-style operation, because of course it was. It makes sense. The scene was filming the next day. The clock was ticking. They weren't just going to fire me and start the search after the fact. They needed to be ready with fresh actors, ready to take the part. And it was essential that I be kept separate from the other actors who were being brought to Hatfield to replace me.
You were possibly urinating next to Tom Hanks before I got fired.
Yeah, I'm thinking that is a very odds-on prediction.
Unlocking the secrets of what happened that day was interesting to me because on the one hand, there was a big conspiracy in the sense that a lot of people were working together to keep all of these moving parts completely separate. But for good reason. There's nothing sinister about it. Actually, quite the contrary. They knew they were probably going to fire me, and they needed to have the other actors on hand, ready to audition and be cast. And they did all this. 2 cars, 2 rooms, putting me in a car as soon as they were done with me, to keep me from having to see the people who were there to replace me. It was a kindness in the midst of a cold, cruel, unemotional process. Everybody had jobs to do. There was work to be done. And they were dealing with me in the best way possible. Remember, they could have just fired me over the phone to my reps. All of this, on some level, was about giving me one last chance. And I blew it. But, you know, what are you going to do?
A few years ago, when I went out to LA to see if I could, like, drive a car, it was just things that I didn't want to. I mean, I know how to drive a car, but I just wanted to see, like, what's it like? And I asked you, because you were in production on your show, do you have anything you can throw my way that I can use to offset the cost of the trip?
Right.
Because I was flying out on my own nickel.
Any little parts we could get.
So you got anything? You're like, oh, I don't have much, but
I got these like scraps in the show. I got like this thing. You're like,
we have a lot of one line parts on our show. Someone comes on, they say exactly one line in a funny voice, and they leave.
So I was cast as like a Freddy Krueger type. It was a Adam Maroon's Halloween.
Yes,
and I was so grateful because it really was just like, oh, this means that like it won't pay for my whole trip, but it'll mean that I won't feel it. You know, yeah, like I'll fly out.
Couple hundred bucks.
Yeah, I showed up and they said, here's your trailer and the. Here's what you'll be wearing, and it's like a sweater and a hat like Freddy Krueger. And he said, here's the rubber mask you'll be wearing. And I looked at it, and I said, I'll be wearing this, and it's just literally like a rubber mask you'd buy at a Party City or at a Halloween store or something.
Right.
And I said, well, you won't be able to hear me very well in that. And I said, oh, well, they're probably going to dub over you.
And they said that?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they said, you don't need to go to hair and makeup because they're not going to see your face. And they're not going to see... so you just... And
I remember this happening, but I didn't know the details of how offensive this was.
And I remember thinking, like, I wonder if Adam knows about this. And then I saw you. You were, like, showing up. You're like, hey, buddy. And you're like, and I was like, hey, Adam, I don't want to be a diva about this, but they cut me a rubber mask. And it was dealt with immediately. It was like, oh, no, you're going to makeup. You're going to be seen.
Yeah, I was like, what's going on? Can we see Connor's face? He flew out here to do this part, and I would like to see his face. And also, he's a funny actor. He's got a funny face. We could see him deliver the line. And they were like, yeah, sure. And then we did that. Can I just say, yeah. I've also done the opposite. Like, I don't know. I don't have a specific example. But, like, I'm on set. I'm the creator of the show. I'm the showrunner of the show. I supervise all the scripts. Every time I'm on set, I'm looking at everything, going like, is this working? And I will often be like, this isn't working. And, you know, can we change this? And a couple times, I'm sure that has resulted in, I don't say, hey, can we lose this guy? But, like, sometimes we end up losing a guy.
At various points, and probably in the immediate aftermath of me getting fired, I had a lot that I was, like, putting on myself, which is just, like, I screwed up. I must have been so bad. But then I went through a phase where I was definitely, like, angry about it and feeling like I'd been wronged. And then eventually, you know, as I lived with the story and thinking about it, I would gradually come around to more realizing that I was such a small piece of such a huge production.
This meant nothing to anyone other than you. Nothing at all. Not a single person involved in this story thought about it again for the rest of their lives. I guarantee you. The reason I don't remember those other stories, I remember the one with your mask because
we were friends.
We were personal. And I felt guilty in that moment because you're my good friend and I wanted to make sure you had a good time on set. And I do try to make sure that everybody has a good time on set. I think of myself as the host of a party kind of, and I want to make sure that people leave the set saying I had a good time, I had a good working experience. At the same time, those couple times that I made a decision that resulted in, hey, can we lose this guy? I don't remember because it didn't matter to me because all I was thinking about was what I had to do next, right? And making sure that shot worked.
Yeah.
And I am making literally thousands of decisions a day. And I don't have time to sweat every single one of them. I just need to have a workflow in place where when I have a thought and decision that needs to be made, I tell somebody and then the thing happens. The fact that Tom Hanks had that experience with you. He saw you. He thought, this isn't working for me for any number of reasons. The reason that you heard was dead eyes, but who knows what he said in that moment. Could have been anything. And he never thought twice about it. He didn't second guess it. They decided, okay, next thing that happens, we're going to have the guy re-audition. He saw that. I don't know. I don't think so. Gone. And that's it. And it could have been any number of reasons. Sure, it could have been that you bombed that scene. It could have been that he was watching you doing that scene and said, I still think he has dead eyes. I still don't like this specific thing, which is a very odd note to make, but it could have been that. Or it could have been that he was having a bad day. Or it could have been that he was in some kind of power struggle with the casting director and he wanted to throw his weight around and show that I'm in charge.
could have been that. It could have been any number of things. But the number one thing I do know about it is that it didn't matter to him at all. It was just one of the thousands of decisions that he made that day, and he never thought about it again. Because as an actor, you are in many ways a human prop. Right? You're there to serve what the director and what the executive producers want, and that's it. And so probably the reason that he re-auditioned you was he really, really, really did not like you. He saw your, what do you think he saw? A photo?
No, he saw my audition tape.
He saw your audition tape, but why did they show him the audition tape?
I think
two days before.
I don't know. Well, he'd been making a movie and then he was coming in to direct the fifth episode.
Got it.
And so he was flying in hot and he's like,
I'm going to watch all the audition tapes.
Yeah.
He sees, so I've got.
Most of it's already cast because there's a regular cast. There would have been very few people in a given episode who would have been new to that episode.
Okay, great. So here's what happened. So Tom Hanks is directing this one episode, but it's unusual for Tom Hanks to direct the episodes. The other episodes are directed by other directors.
Yes.
And so those directors have a long pre-production period. However, Tom Hanks is coming into this episode. I'm directing it. So I want to actually direct it. I don't want to just be one of those actors who says he directs the episode, but really they've got a producer on there who's really making all the decisions. No, no, no. I know what directing is. I want to make all the decisions. So all the decisions that the director would normally make, I'm going to make them too. So I'm going to do location scouts, I'm going to talk to all the department heads, and I want to approve all the actors, just like the directors do. However, my schedule is so tight, being Tom Hanks, I must watch all the tapes 2 or 3 days beforehand. They say, okay, well, that's very fine, Mr. Hanks, so you can absolutely do that. They hope against hope that he doesn't have a problem with any of the choices because it's going to be so hard to make a change at that time. He watches all the tapes. He sees yours, and he feels very strongly, hold on a second, it cannot be this man. And he says he has dead eyes. Presumably, he says that because that somehow found its way to you. And the chain of who had to tell who to get all the way to, that's a problem in itself. Everyone was wrong. He was fine to say that, but the executive producer should not have told that to the casting director. The casting director should not have told that to your agent. Your agent should not have told that to you. So he sees that tape. He says, I really don't like this guy. Now, does he really feel that way very strongly, or is he making a statement? Could be a little bit of both. Doesn't really matter one way or another. He has made this point. They say, Mr. Hanks, we are filming tomorrow in 2 days. We're filming very, very soon. This is going to be really hard to make this change. He says, he puts his foot down, either because he feels very strongly or because he is trying to make a statement. I am the director. For whichever reason why, that's what he chooses to do at that time. They say, Mr. Hanks, this is going to be a problem. Let's at least try to make it work. Could we try to make it work? And he, being a good boss and director, says, yes, of course. You have a chance to win me over and make it work without this big disruptive change. They say, oh, my God, thank you so much, Mr. Hanks, because we really don't want to have to cast a new actor and get new wardrobe and do X, Y, Z. So we're all very hopeful that we can make this work. And so they bring you into that room specifically as a way of bargaining with Tom Hanks to try to get him to avoid making this disruptive change. That's why you're there. And that's why they're pulling for you. And unfortunately, Mr. Hanks was not won over by what occurred in that room. And he said, I got to go with my gut here. We're going to have to make a change here. I'm sorry everyone has to work late tonight. But let me be very clear. Those are the only people he felt bad about inconveniencing. Not you, because that is the actor's lot in life.
If I had to bet money, if someone was like, bet everything you've got on whether, honestly, I think I have dead eyes on that tape. If I had to bet everything, I would bet that I do have dead eyes on that tape. Because I've seen it. I've seen it.
You've seen your own eyes be dead?
I know what I picture when I think about him thinking that. I've seen it.
There's two reads. There's either this man's eyes make me contemplate his mortality and my own in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
Which wouldn't have been bad for a World War II set. You know, like.
No, that's the odd thing about it.
Yeah.
The other way is this man's eyes are not acting. He has blank eyes. His mouth is moving, but his face is not acting. His judgment that you have dead eyes, that you have thought about for 2 decades nearly, was not a deep, considered revelation about your appearance. It was the firstest of first impressions.
Adam Conover gets it.
because he knows what it's like to run a TV show. It wasn't personal. It was business. Show business. But I took it personally because I'm a person.
Again, this meant nothing to Tom Hanks.
In the next episode of Dead Eyes, I'll talk to SNL's Bobby Moynihan, who was a major part of one of the greatest and most unexpected triumphs of Tom Hanks' career.
How's it hanging? I'm David Pumpkins!
I would go as far as saying the only time David Pumpkins happened when it was funny was live on air.
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Adam Conover, Adam Sims, and Mael Dalivaux. If you want to listen to an extended version of Mael's panel-by-panel discussion of my day with Tom Hanks comic, you can actually find it online. I made a video of it. Mael has a new book coming out called I Will Live Forever. You can pre-order it now from Beehive Books. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast. Talk about it on social media. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you're friends with Tom Hanks, who, by the way, is one of my all-time favorite SNL hosts from all the way back to when he was doing recurring characters like Mr. Short-Term Memory. He's one of a very small handful of hosts, and I mean this as the highest possible praise, who hosts the show as if he used to be a cast member. You can tell him I said that. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
That was a HeadGum Original.